It's Central Time, broadcasting today from the WPR studios in Milwaukee. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, in the 1920s, garden homes were built as part of a progressive housing project in Milwaukee. We talk about ongoing efforts to preserve those houses, their history, and the vision behind them.
First, the city of Waukesha is continuing its efforts to get approval to divert water from Lake Michigan because of radium contamination in its local groundwater supply. But the 10 U.S. states and Canadian provinces that border the Great Lakes have to agree to the request, and there are still questions and concerns to be addressed.
The latest chapter in the ongoing negotiations happened this week in Chicago, where a committee judged Waukesha's application as meeting the technical requirements of the Great Lakes Water Protection Compact. That sends it on now to the next step in the approval process.
Chuck Kornbach joins us in the studio now. He's a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee, and he's been following this story from the start. Chuck, good to see you here in Milwaukee.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, what did this committee of the Great Lakes states and Canadian provinces have to say about Waukesha's request?
Well, they held a meeting, actually it was by webinar. Some folks were in Chicago, others were elsewhere in the Midwest, Great Lakes region, and they voted 9-0, with only Minnesota abstaining, that the proposal should be advanced or forwarded to the Great Lakes governors, and that'll happen over the next 30 days, in about 30 days.
Now that this advancement has come out, are we hearing anything about what the committee members had to say about why they decided to advance this request from Waukesha?
Well, most thought that it met the standards of the Great Lakes Compact, which was signed in 2008, that they had attached various conditions over the last couple of months that they thought would keep it in line with the compact. The main parts of those conditions include reducing the amount of territory in Waukesha County that would get lake water to primarily just the city of Waukesha's current service area, plus some isolated parts, they call them islands, within the town of Waukesha that are completely surrounded by the city. So that was the main thing, cut down the size of the service area, knock out some of the surrounding communities, Genesee, parts of Pewaukee, and so on, that were in line to get water as well. There were some other conditions as well addressing that would reduce the amount of water that the communities would get from roughly 10 million gallons when this proposal started, now down to about 8.2, 8.3 on a typical day.
And did the city of Waukesha, did they have to sign off on all of these attached conditions before it went forward?
Well, the city of Waukesha, I believe, was in negotiation and collaboration with the Wisconsin DNR. It was actually Wisconsin, you know, was on this committee as one of the states. The DNR chose Eric Ebersberger, longtime employee, and who has worked quite closely, perhaps most closely, with this project over the last few years. He was the delegate, and he, you know, made some comments that were appreciative of the committee's work. But a little bit controversial. He said that he was glad they didn't listen to considerable hyperbole on this. I believe referring to many, many comments from environmental groups, citizen groups that oppose this plan, and yet it's been advanced because the committee, by and large, thinks it meets the standards of the compact.
Now, you said, going back to something you said Minnesota abstained from the vote. Is this an abstention such that this just isn't the right time, or is this more of a protest vote?
Well, Julie Ekman, Minnesota's delegate to what was called the regional body, said that this should not be taken as a sign of Governor Dayton in Minnesota's opposition just now, that they wanted more time. Minnesota had asked for the week delay from the previous meeting in Chicago a week ago. She had asked for a week more to consider this, but apparently was not ready to vote yesterday on this. But again, warned that don't take this as a no, just take this as we haven't fully studied this yet. There is some political difference at the governor's level in Minnesota and Wisconsin, so we're trying to see if there's some politics behind this. But for right now, they're just saying it's give us more time, and we'll be ready to, the governor will be ready in about a month.
We're talking with Chuck Kornbach right now, WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee, and he's giving us an update on the city of Waukesha's application to divert water from Lake Michigan. And looking now a little bit more closely at the Great Lakes governors who'll be taking it up down the road, what are the stakes there? What happens?
Well, there will be a meeting somewhere around June 21st, 22nd, at which some of the governors may be there, or they may just send their representatives. I think some of them are on this regional body already. I'm not so sure what's going to happen in the next 30 days. The key thing is that any governor can veto this project, just takes one. And so there will be, and the Wisconsin DNR said, look, we're willing and glad to work with those that have not reached consensus yet, meaning Minnesota mainly, but also Michigan, which okayed the plan yesterday, but their representative, Grant Trigger, said, listen, you know, this does not mean Governor Rick Snyder is ready to fully embrace this yet. He's going to decide in about 30 days. So there's going to be some negotiations that we may hear about, or maybe not, and then all of a sudden, and they'll gather together again, it appears.
Do you have any idea what the specific concerns are for the governors of Minnesota and possibly Michigan at this point, Chuck?
Well, Minnesota mentioned a week ago that they didn't think there'd been enough public input, that there was some concern about the return flow of treated wastewater once the people of Waukesha are done using the Lake Michigan water. It would go to the sewage treatment plant out there, which is expanding for various reasons, but including to be able to prepare wastewater to be piped over to the Franklin area, where it would be released into the Root River, and which flows through southern Milwaukee County down through part of Racine County into the city of Racine. Some concern from environmental groups and certainly Racine's mayor and one of their state representatives, Corey Mason, about the quality of that return flow, whether it would truly keep out things like pharmaceuticals and viruses.
Any sense about how that kind of concern could be addressed?
Well, the committee, the regional body, addressed the return flow somewhat, but they were saying, you know, Waukesha promised, and the DNR said, listen, this wastewater is going to meet all standards, all current standards, and if there are standards developed nationally on things like pharmaceutical pass-through, if you will, that Waukesha would meet those standards too. Yet to see whether any of the opponents would be talking lawsuit yet. It's hard to say for sure, but Mayor Dickert in Racine told me about a week ago that, listen, I'm going to do all I can to protect my city.
Now, we've talked mainly about concerns from Minnesota, maybe some from Michigan, but there are also Canadian provinces involved here, too. Do you have a sense about how involved in this and how high stakes a question this is going to be for Canada?
Well, it was a little odd. A delegate from Quebec that started out being on the committee asked several questions and raised some concerns. He was not the delegate, though, at the final meeting last week in Chicago or by phone yesterday. I'm not trying to imply there was a political change, but Quebec went from raising questions to, at the end, going along with things. Ontario was a bit more cautious. In fact, right as the members were having their vote yesterday, Ontario's delegate asked for a 10-minute recess, and people kind of like, okay. But I think he was just checking back with higher-ups in the Ontario administration. So, so far, it seems the Canadian governments are on board, at least at the end there.
So, Chuck, it's cleared this committee. It's going to go on to the Great Lakes governors. If you had to characterize the atmosphere around this and just the feeling you're getting about its viability, what is your sense of where it's at?
Well, it appears, you know, most of the governments are on board, the state governments and the provincial governments. The wild card, things like Minnesota's governor, it appears, potentially Michigan's governor, who's feeling a lot of heat over the Flint water situation. Environmental groups are out there saying, you know, this is a flawed proposal. We want to do more assessment. There's always the possibility of lawsuits and these sorts of things. But then you also think of the scope of this project, $200 million project, people building pipelines from somewhere in Oak Creek out to the city of Waukesha, and a return flow pipeline that would be these 20-mile pipes, parallel pipes each way. You think it's quite an immense project, and it's certainly a different kind of field than looking over Lake Michigan, which we can barely see, and thinking that no one would try to tap into that.
And Chuck, just briefly as we wrap up here, if the proposal clears the Great Lakes governors, where does it go next?
Well, it's my understanding that would be the end of the sort of official government plan unless there was some sort of change in the process. But again, it could go to the courts if there's a lawsuit.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach joining us in the Milwaukee studios, giving us an update on the city of Waukesha's application to divert water from Lake Michigan.
Concerns over fair and affordable housing are nothing new here in Wisconsin. 90 years ago, a progressive housing project featuring a community of garden homes aimed to change the landscape of the city. And today, the project near West Atkinson and North Teutonia Avenues in Milwaukee faces an uncertain future.
These Milwaukee garden homes were placed on the National Register of Historic Places and have been seen as a model for low-income housing. But some of these homes are boarded up now, and because of their unique social history, activists and homeowners are fighting to preserve them.
Joining us now is Mary Louise Schumacher. She's the art and architecture critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She wrote about the historic garden homes in Milwaukee. Mary Louise, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, sometimes we think historic just means old, but these houses seem like they have a little more significance. Can you tell the story of how they came to be built?
Sure. Well, the garden homes were built in the early 1920s. They were part of the utopian vision of one of our early, actually the very first socialist mayor in Milwaukee, Emil Seidel. And they were really conceived of as a form of affordable housing that people would buy into. They would own a share of the neighborhood and actually cooperatively own it. So it was the first municipally owned cooperative neighborhood in the country.
Now, low-income housing at this point in history, what did that usually mean?
Well, and it's interesting. When you think about it, at the time was an alternative to tenement housing downtown. So the people who would have moved into these homes might have been living in parts of downtown where they were really suffocating from factory air and really terrible living conditions, very cramped. And these homes were set out from the city. They were out in the middle of rural lands, you know, surrounded by farmland. They were very charming, small, quaint cottages that would have felt really like a dream for a lot of those people to kind of get out of the city into the clean air and have a beautiful home with working plumbing and a beautiful little dining room. By today's standards, these homes are very small, but to the folks who moved into them in the early 20s, they would have been really kind of great, spacious homes.
And do we know who the people moving into these homes would have been? Are we talking maybe recent immigrants or second-generation immigrants to Milwaukee?
They would have been mostly families, middle-income families who were working in manufacturing. I mean, this neighborhood today exists just north of where the manufacturing base in our city is. So these are people who would have, you know, gone not that far away to work in the factories during the day shifts and the night shifts and that sort of thing. So they would have been average middle class families. They were, I will say, white families, which is not uncommon for the time. But
exclusively.
It's something, exclusively. It was a whites-only neighborhood, which is something to note because, of course, today it's a predominantly black neighborhood.
Can you talk about some of the history? Milwaukee obviously has changed a lot over the last 90 years. Manufacturing has changed a lot in Milwaukee. How has that neighborhood changed between then and now? And we'll dig into now more specifically.
Sure. Well, of course, you had the collapse of the manufacturing era in the city. And then, you know, more recently you had the foreclosure crisis. And even more recently than that, you have this wave of tax foreclosures, which is happening much more recently. I suppose to backtrack a little bit, you know, the city did, when it was booming, kind of grow up to and out around this neighborhood. So at the time, it would have been kind of outside of the city. Now it's really right in the middle of the city. So that's kind of where it is today.
Well, and let's look at today now. Why are people concerned with what happens to these cottage homes now? Why are people starting to see them as an important part of Milwaukee's heritage?
Well, for one reason, they are really on the brink of losing their historic character. I mean, these were built with a very specific purpose. They are a piece of our heritage. You know, Emil Seidel, the mayor who envisioned this neighborhood, actually thought it was so important that he moved in. And his home is today a board up and abandoned. And you can when you go there today, what you see are few remnants of those original cottages. Some of them are, you know, the porches are sloping and falling off. The roofs are in bad shape. Many of them have aluminum siding on them. And that is very different than what these homes looked like originally. They were quaint, stucco-covered, colonial revival homes, and that character is really on the brink of being lost.
Now, this might be an area where people are thinking more about issues like crime and violence,
right,
or a stagnant economy, jobs, things like that. Are a lot of the people, especially living in this area, thinking historic preservation should be up in our list of priorities?
Yeah, there's all kinds of dichotomies in this neighborhood. There are all of these forces kind of clashing. So on the one hand, you have, you know, very high-profile shooting deaths in this neighborhood. You have prostitution in this neighborhood. I spent a lot of time in this neighborhood and saw, you know, drug dealing on the street very blatantly. And yet, at the same time, you have people who've lived in this neighborhood for a couple of generations who are really dedicated to it and take very good care of their own properties and are active and really engaged in trying to preserve it. So it's, these things are kind of in constant struggle.
Talking to Mary Louise Schumacher from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about historic garden homes in Milwaukee built in the 1920s. People see them as a big part of the city's history, city's heritage, but in decline, as she's saying, and an effort now to preserve them. Let's talk about this effort to preserve, I guess, the individual houses and the neighborhood as a whole. Have people gotten together and come up with a vision? This is what we want this to look like. This is what we see this this neighborhood, what role people see it filling?
Well, to its credit, the city of Milwaukee has really taken a leadership role. So 8 of the 93 structures in the garden homes have fallen into the city's hands through tax foreclosure. And the city of Milwaukee has completely renovated 2 of the homes so that you can really see this is what these homes looked like when they were new in 1921 or 1923. And then a third home was restored inside and out and sold. So there is this, you know, sort of movement to kind of show the community as a sort of demonstration project what's possible. But the math doesn't always work. So some of these homes, it might take $100,000 or more to fix them up completely and appropriately to historic preservation standards. And yet they might sell for, you know, $31,000. So a developer coming into that situation has got a major challenge on his hands. And you really need a developer with a sense of mission and a heart for the project. I spoke to Howard Snyder, who is with the Northwest Side Community Development Corporation, who's working with PNC Bank and WIDA to try to find the kind of financing mix that would include tax credits, but also maybe some really creative grants and other forms of funding to kind of cobble it all together and come up with a deal.
There's a conflict, I think, whenever there's talk of historic preservation between the idea of this is a piece of history, almost a living museum, and a living neighborhood,
right,
in real-world Milwaukee now. Are people trying to thread that needle and use this as both somehow?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that's really important to note about historic preservation is that it can be a burden for people who own these properties. The neighborhood voted overwhelmingly, however, for the historic designation back in 2013, which is relatively recent, actually. But the homes were being threatened with demolition, and so the neighborhood actually rallied around the idea of historic preservation in order to keep these homes intact, and so they're kind of behind the whole idea, I think.
Are there preservation and restoration projects going on right now? Are there homes where there's work being done in them right now?
Well, the city at this point is really in what I would call a mothballing phase. So what that means is that they've done these three homes really, mm-hmm, really well, and those that are falling into their hands now are stabilized. So they make sure that there's a good roof, that it's water tight, and that it's a stable property that can be revitalized by somebody else at a later time. And that is pretty much all that's going on right now. Now, Howard Snyder is doing everything he can to find the financing to do a whole group of homes all at once. And when you go to the neighborhood today, you'll see a bunch of signs that say, you know, basically, you could live in this house. And that's because Howard Snyder and the Northwest Side Community Development Corporation have kind of put a hold on these homes with the hopes of doing several of them all at once.
In the 1920s, as you said, these were a lovely alternative to living in a tenement.
Yes.
Are these houses, when they're refurbished and restored to some of their historic properties. Are these places that people want to live in now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, they were built with completely different ideas in mind, but by many of today's best standards for urban living, they're small homes on small lots. They're near a commercial district. They're near transportation. There is a lot of density for a neighborhood. These are really the best practices for contemporary urbanism. So I think, and they're charming little houses. I mean, I would love to live in this house. You know, there's this incredible popularity around micro homes. And honestly, I think these sort of are kind of the equivalent of a micro home. They just were built a century ago.
Well, Mary Louise, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
You bet.
That was Mary Louise Schumacher. She's the art and architecture critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been telling us about efforts to preserve historic garden homes that were part of a progressive housing project in Milwaukee in the 1920s. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're happy to be broadcasting today from the WPR studios in Milwaukee. And coming up, we'll do a little time traveling and visit Milwaukee in the 1930s.
First, your typical summer beach reads are light, fairly easy, usually fiction. But Central Time listeners, we know you love learning. So we're bringing our science expert on now to talk about some smart, science-y books you could still relax with on your summer vacation.
And we want your suggestions, too, at 800-486-8655. Do you have a favorite science book to share? Do you need some recommendations? And what is the best science book that you've ever read? You can call in now at 800-486-8655 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Gemma Tarlak is in the studio with us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to talk to you in person.
Hello, it's great to be here in person. It's exciting.
Well, before we get to specific recommendations, what to you makes a really good science read?
Oh, for the summer, now we're talking, right?
Sure, anytime, yeah. But especially the summer.
Well, you know, to me, science has to be fun. You know, it has to be fun and it has to be enjoyable and entertaining. Yes, it's serious. You want to learn stuff as well, but there has to be a fun element. So I really look for a science summer read that is enjoyable. It's something that if you put the book down to put on some more sunblock or whatever, you turn to the person next to you and you're like, can you believe this? And this, you know, you want to share what you're learning.
And you've been reviewing some science reads for Discover Magazine. What's been fitting that particular bill recently as you get ready to look into summer? We're not quite there yet, but you're already thinking summer reads.
Well, there are a bunch. And you know, with our production schedule, I was actually reading summer reads back in January and February. So really, that's how it works.
But you're still on the beach with the sunscreen because you're a method
yes.
writer.
In my parka. And I have to say there are a couple clear favorites for me. And one of them is actually already out. It's called Death on Earth, and it's by British zoologist Jules Howard. It is probably the funniest book you'll read about the science of death ever. He just has a really witty, self-deprecating, fun tone, and you're learning a ton. You're getting really deep into defining life, defining death, but you're really enjoying it. It's just like a really well done book. And I also loved his earlier book, Sex on Earth. He's got kind of a theme going, all the big things, yeah.
And you interviewed the author of Death on Earth and for your new blog on the Discover Magazine website. As I understand it, part of the problem in understanding death scientifically is trying to figure out what life means.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's so many different ways of defining life. And, you know, you might think, well, respiration. One of the ways to define life is respiration. But technically, your refrigerator breathes. In a way. And so, you know, there are all these things. And then you look at something like a tardigrade. Tardigrade are these microscopic animals. They're also called, favorite thing ever, moss piglets. Okay, so they're these microscopic little animals. They live all over. You can find them in outer space. And they can go dormant and just be essentially dead for years. And then wake up again and be like, fine, floating around. So how do you really define what life is? That's an intriguing question. And he kind of gets at a couple different ways of looking at it.
I loved where you asked, and this is in your blog, but you asked him, you know, what made him sort of uncomfortable as he did this. And his answers were pretty interesting, especially, you know, what it was like to hang out with people who refused to accept that we might die someday.
Right, yeah. He has this wonderful, wonderful chapter on going to one of those anti-aging conferences, but I don't mean anti-aging just like putting on a little skin cream to get rid of the wrinkles. I mean people who are, you know, injecting other people's plasma and stuff just to prolong their life. And he's just very uncomfortable because these people are just, almost a different species to him. And he actually gets physically sick at the conference, and it's kind of hysterical because he is very self-deprecating, and you're feeling it, you know, while he's there, but you're also laughing at him a little bit, gotta say.
Well, the subtitle of Death on Earth is Adventures in Evolution and Mortality. So is the idea that there's an evolutionary benefit to dying? Seems kind of that cross purposes in some ways.
Well, when you think about it, you know, we talk always about survival of the fittest, but it's really not survival of the individual necessarily. It's really survival of the species of the fittest. So if you think about it, if nothing ever died, we would run out of resources very quickly. And also, you know, there are a lot of plants, a lot of microorganisms that need something to die in order to have a food resource.
And so that's one of your favorites, and an interview with the author is up on the blog. And there was another that you talked about, made me think twice as someone who's sort of simultaneously fascinated by and terrified by snakes, one looking at rattlesnakes.
Yeah, Ted Levin, he's a zoologist, I believe out of New England. He wrote a book called America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. And I just love this book because I like snakes. They're nothing to be afraid of. Trust me, it's okay. It's going to be okay. And he just looks at really all different aspects of it. And, you know, the rattlesnake in America, it's not just a snake. It is like the pinnacle of evolution of snakes in a lot of different ways. And he gets into the physiology, he gets into the evolution, and then he gets into the whole, you know, in certain aspects, it's revered. It's kind of like this, oh, this iconic, incredible animal, but then it's feared, and people want to get rid of it, people want to conserve it. So he really gets into all sides of the argument. It's fascinating.
And what does he say about where we are now in that whole, it's evil and going to kill us and we need to kill it first, versus it's part of the ecosystem and we need to preserve it?
Well, the good news is I think people more and more and more are recognizing, not just herpetologists, but just the average person are recognizing that we need to preserve these animals. You know, they were here before us. They should be here after us. I'm sorry. Let me keep turning the conversation to death.
That's okay. But you like dead things. We'll
know,
talk about
it's,
that more later.
It's true. But yeah, that we're kind of understanding we have to figure out a way to live with all these animals and all these American ecosystems rather than just get rid of them. And so he does get into conservation methods and ways we're protecting them.
Well, the subtitle of that book is The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. So does that mean that the timber rattlesnake has got some bad news right now?
Well, I mean, their population is dwindling, and while we should conserve them, there are still people who do not take kindly to them when they see them. And so it's a hopeful book, I have to say. But, you know, we have to get through kind of a low period before we can get back on the upswing.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We're here in our Milwaukee studios talking about great science reads, especially for the summer. Let's go to a caller now at 800-486-8655. We'll try bringing on Caleb in Woodstock, Illinois. Caleb, hi, you're on the air. No, we'll keep noodling around. Caleb, hi, are you there?
Hello, yeah.
Yep, go ahead, Caleb.
Hi, yeah, I was calling in to suggest a book by author, inventor, futurist, and current director of engineering at Google called a man named Raymond Kurzweil. He wrote a book a couple years back called How to Create a Mind, and it's just kind of a really fascinating read. He goes over in details kind of our current understandings of the brain and how he's been able to use a lot of our current understandings to develop algorithms and stuff, such as speech recognition software and all kinds of stuff like that. So it kind of lets the readers understand what we all have on top of our heads a little better and more in depth, and also gives a kind of a broader hope for the future of brain development.
Caleb, thanks a lot for that call. I've not read anything by Ray Kurzweil, Gemma, but I understand it's pretty mind-blowing stuff a lot of the time. It's cutting-edge brain research, the future of machine intelligence, that kind of thing. Any other good research or reading out there along those lines lately?
Well, you know, there is a book, I think it just came out right about now. It's by Sean Carroll. It's called The Big Picture, and it's on the origins of life, the meaning, a universe itself. It's kind of a mouthful to say, but I would say it's not really a lighter read. It's a read where you really have to be in a situation where you can sink your teeth into it. But he does get into a lot of the big picture issues, a lot of the way physics plays out in our lives that you might not think about as we're driving down the road. So it's a good read, though. I'd recommend it for sure.
And Gemma, any thoughts on Ray Kurzweil? I think, isn't he someone who's pretty into anti-aging as well?
You know, I think so, but I'm not an expert on him, so I haven't read anything by him.
Good.
Sorry.
To get a recommendation there from Caleb. And by the way, you can keep the calls coming, 800-486-8655. What is your favorite science read? What about a good beachy summer science read? Let us know at 800-486-8655. And Gemma, you also you profile a book talking about honeybees and sort of the language of the ways that the bees communicate with each other physically, almost like a dance.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing about this research is it goes way back to the 30s and 40s. A researcher by the name of Carl von Frisch actually noticed that bees communicate through basically, you know, hammer time for bees. And so he
with
was
able... With the pants and everything?
Yes, absolutely, with the pants. And he really started to decode how bees communicate. And it's fascinating because a lot of times we think of communication as, you know, being able to speak, being able to do certain things. And other animals have it figured out. You know, they'll never be on the radio, obviously, because they dance, they don't talk. But still, really great read.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine now about science book recommendations for the summer.
And we're taking your calls, and you can join the conversation at 800-486-8655. Tell us about your favorite books about science. And you can also share magazines and blogs, too. That's 800-486-8655. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine about smart summer science reads.
And we're taking your recommendations too at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. What makes a good science read? Is there a science book you've read lately that you'd want to recommend? We'll even branch out a little if you've got some really sciencey science fiction for us. Call now at 800-486-8655. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Monica on the line in Pewaukee. Monica, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two recommendations. These are more science fiction, but they are very enjoyable and they keep your attention for sure. One of them is Zoo by James Patterson, and the other one is Ready Player One. I don't remember the author.
I can almost remember the author of Ready Player One, but I can't. Do you remember, Rob?
I can't think
You've
of it either.
It.
I have, and it pushed. Thank you so much for that, Monica. Ready Player One pressed all my nerd buttons. It's set in the future, but basically all the pop culture is derived from my childhood and teenage years, from, you know, comic books to the movies to Dungeons and Dragons. Science fiction, Gemma, are there science fiction reads you might recommend for the summer? I don't know. You're a science writer. I assume you're a science fiction person. Am I wrong?
Well, I have a dirty little secret, and I know no one else is listening now, right?
Right. It's okay. Just us.
Okay. So I do so much reading at work that, when I'm not at work for enjoyment, I pretty much watch police procedurals on ION TV. Law and Order, Criminal Minds, yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's hard taking your work home with you.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. Well, we're not expressly science people on Central Time. We are when we talk to you, but I like to go science fiction because it's the opposite of what we're doing during the day. So I appreciate those recommendations, Monica. Zoo and Ready Player One, which I think is going to be a movie.
I think so, too. Yeah, and that's a bit of a thriller. And then you've got a real-life thriller, Gemma, getting back to your list, one called The Winter Fortress, and this is about sabotaging Hitler's atomic bomb project.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. And, you know, Neil Bascom, the author, has done a lot of World War II books, and he's really very well researched. But he got access, for the first time ever, I believe, to the journals of some of the scientists who were trying to build Hitler's bomb. And so he really brings in their perspectives. If you can imagine, you're the scientist, and, you know, Der Fuhrer says, build me a bomb. You're like, oh, great. So that's a terrific, and also in terms of thrillers, I really strongly recommend The Dragon Behind the Glass. It's by Emily Voigt, and it opens with this absolutely spectacular, tragic, but just gripping murder scene. And it's nonfiction, and it's all about this the most expensive tropical fish that people are just going bananas over collecting for their aquariums. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's
for
really
a fish.
For a fish that's just a couple feet long, and it just, you know, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't like shoot laser beams out of its eyes or anything. It's a fish, and it's associated with good luck in some Asian cultures. And there are these bidding wars and this whole like underground trade and organized crime built around this fish.
Wow.
And it's just incredibly written. Very
sounds
exciting.
Sort of like the orchid thief for fish.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Inside the tropical world, the underground world of rare fish collectors.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. Well, another one that you really liked, Gemma, was called Choice or Chance: Understanding Your Locus of Control and Why It Matters. Tell us about that one.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I don't know about you, but I have a lot of friends on Facebook who will say things like, oh, the guy ahead of me in line cut me off. That's my sign to buy a lottery ticket or, you know, whatever. Just like these very weird associations. And Stephen Nowicki, the author, really gets into, okay, what is actually controllable in your life? What is just coincidence? How can you recognize the two? What does it mean when your brain interprets everything as, oh, this means that I must do that, or this means that this is going to happen? And just really gets into kind of the neuroscience of superstition and believing, seeing connections that maybe aren't quite there. So I really like it. It's really interesting.
Is this one of those that kind of changes the way you think in your daily life, having read this? Do you start to second guess yourself?
You know, now that you've said that, I really feel like it's a sign.
Right. Me saying that's a sign that...
Well, I think what you get out of the book depends on both how superstitious you are to begin with and also how open you are to admitting your superstition. I think that depends. But he lays it out in a very accessible, easy to understand kind of way.
And we're taking your calls right now for your favorite science reads. What's a great one that you read? Maybe you're looking for a recommendation from Gemma. Well, you can reach us right now. Give us a call at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. And Gemma, another one that rung your bell a little bit was about paper.
Yeah. You know, Mark Kurlansky wrote a great book called Cod, and he takes these kind of like big things and topics that really stretch over history and geography, and he really kind of lays them out in terms of how that particular invention or particular ingredient or object impacted world history and how we can trace world history through this one thing. And in this case, he's looking at paper all the way from, you know, the very first scratchings on pieces of papyrus all the way up till now. And, you know, a lot of people say this is kind of the death of paper with the increasingly digitization of our world. But he makes a good case for why we maybe don't want to get rid of paper.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about great science reads. And, of course, a lot of science writing is in blog form these days, Gemma. You have a new one, and we've known this about you. You are obsessed one way or another with dead things, early human history, paleontology, things like that. What are you covering on your dead things blog?
Well, I wouldn't say obsessed, really. I mean,
I don't like to argue with our guests, but I'd say obsessed.
Okay. I am a bit Wednesday Addams. I will admit that. But I started this blog, Dead Things, at discovermagazine.com. And really, you know, we know a lot of our readers are very interested in fossils, very interested in paleoanthropology and paleontology. And we just thought, let's have a blog that can really kind of meet their needs. So it's a little bit of everything. Sometimes I'll interview authors like Jules Howard, who did the great book Death on Earth. Sometimes I'll talk about the latest news. We had a couple of really cool horned dinosaurs that were just formally described for the first time earlier this week. Sometimes, you know, if a controversy comes up about what is this fossil? Hey, is it Neanderthal? Is it human? How do we know? You know, I'll look at that. So it's just a little bit of everything and trying to just, you know, give our readers something to look forward to in terms of dead things.
Well, let's take a caller now. We've got Elise on the line in Wauwatosa. Elise, hi.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
So my recommendation is How Dogs Love Us, subtitle, Neuroscientist and His Adopted Dog Decode the Canine Brain. I just finished it on vacation. And I laughed, I cried, it was so good, and it's just a really, for all the dog lovers out there.
What did you learn about how dogs love us?
So, basically, I guess I just kind of learned that, you know, my dog is, well, we're part of the same pack, and this part of the brain lights up when she sees me, the same part that lights up the reward system.
Nice. Elise, thank you so much for sharing that. Lots of people love dogs, feel the same way you do, Elise. And that one was called How Dogs Love Us.
Gemma, you're nodding here.
Yeah, I read that book. And I have to admit that the entire book, I couldn't get over one fact. That they got their dogs, the researchers got their dogs to lay down motionless in the MRI machine to check their brains. And I'm like, how do you do that? Like, how much peanut butter do you give them to make them just lie still? My dogs do not
do
that.
That's great.
Time for one more quick call. Nina in Trempolo. Nina, hi.
Hi. I was listening and I heard you guys talking about books and favorite books, and I just wanted to share one of my old favorites.
What is it?
Thomas Lewis's Lives of a Cell.
Oh, yeah. It's a series of essays, I think. Lewis Thomas, that's one I've actually read, and pretty good. I assume there's more up-to-the-date biology because that book's been around a while, Gemma. You know, we're actually a little short on time. How big is your stack of two reads right now, Gemma?
It's not a stack. It's actually...
room?
It's a wall
storage
in my room.
Facility?
Yeah. It's a pile and a pile and a pile and a pile.
And for your blog, Dead Things, which is new, what can we expect to see there in the near future?
Well, actually, fingers crossed, I am planning an upcoming trip soon to the Republic of Georgia, which, in addition to being the cradle of wine, it's where they started making wine, it's also where they found the oldest hominids outside of Africa. And I'm hoping to check those out and report back.
Nice. Well, we'll look forward to that.
Gemma, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Gemma Tarlak here in our Milwaukee WPR studio. Gemma Tarlak is senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joined us to talk about her suggestions for smart summer reads. Still time for you to share your favorite science reads. And we're talking books, magazines, or put up a link to your favorite science blog. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And don't worry, Gemma will be back with us. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology.
And it's a cool day for us here on Central Time because we're hosting the show today in our Milwaukee studio for the first time ever.
Yeah, we're a little bit late on this. Before we even started Central Time, we said, okay, we're going to plan it. We're going to get over to the Milwaukee studio within the first 3 months of the show.
Well, we were close. We got here within our first 3 years of the show.
So just,
here we are.
Just one order of magnitude off there. Well, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what you'd recommend for a must-do list in Milwaukee. And I don't actually get to do anything today. We're just doing the show, but we'll come back. And we want to hear about some of your favorite Milwaukee places to go, things to eat, places to take the kids, and where to get outside and enjoy nature and enjoy the summer. We're going to take your calls later in the show, but you can get us started right now. What is on your Milwaukee must-do list? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share some of your favorites there.
That's right. My grandparents were from Milwaukee. So growing up, I spent a lot of time in the city, but I'm looking forward to re-exploring it now. I've done a little bit of that. The public market I love. I love the zoo. I will always love the zoo.
Great museums.
The public museum I love. But what else is out there? We really want you to let us know what you love to do here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I have the restaurants of Milwaukee are ridiculously underexplored by me. So give us some recommendations on the Central Time Facebook page. Stick around. There's more to come from a Milwaukee edition of Central Time.